the rebel girl.
When you look at newspaper clippings or articles about her, they always talk about how beautiful she was and how striking she looked and just what a presence she had. I think she had a lot of charisma and just an incredible ability to connect with her audience, and that really carried through throughout her whole life.
That's Lara Vapnik. We talk with her about her biography of the great labor organizer and champion of civil liberties, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn. And later, we talk with civil liberties lawyer and journalist, Bill Newman, about his book, When the War Came Home. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. In 1906, 15-year-old Elizabeth Gurley Flynn mounted a soapbox in Times Square to denounce capitalism and proclaim a new era for women's freedom. She wowed the crowd and went on to become one of America's most important leaders for workers' rights. Beginning with the Wobblies and continuing with the Communist Party's organizing of modern unions in the 1930s, Flynn not only inspired the labor movement, but also developed new ways of organizing that advanced its cause. She also was a tireless champion of free speech rights and the rights of women and other civil liberties. My guest, historian Lara Vapnik, has just come out with a new biography, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, Modern American Revolutionary. Well, Lara Vapnik, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
So you wrote this wonderful book about Elizabeth Gurley Flynn. She was known as the Rebel Girl after a song that was written about her by the great Joe Hill. She began agitating at the age of 16. Tell us what brought her to radical politics at such an early age.
I think in a lot of ways, it started with her family background. Her parents were both extremely radical. They had both been involved in the Knights of Labor, which was this radical organization that really became popular in the 1880s. So her parents both had this radical labor background, but also they were Irish immigrants, so they had really had the experience of hard work, to some degree exploitation, especially her father, who grew up in Maine and his whole family worked in the granite quarries. He saw a lot of family members injured or maimed by their work. So that was the influence of her father. And then her mother was also a hard worker, but in a way she was more privileged. She was a little bit more what they called white curtain Irish. So they were both Irish, but her mother was from a slightly more affluent family, and she was actually a skilled seamstress. But she was a very strong advocate of women's rights. And so I think that strong belief in women's rights from her mother, combined with her father's kind of intense class consciousness, really came together to give her a radical outlook.
This was in New York. Tell us a little bit about New York and American society at the turn of the century.
Well, basically, America was industrializing really rapidly. There were millions of immigrants coming in, especially people from Southern and Eastern Europe. So cities like New York were growing really quickly, and there were just all kinds of people coming in. And often they just took any job they could get, and a lot of the work was really exploitative, basically. So those were the labor conditions in New York. In the Bronx, where Elizabeth Gurley Flynn grew up, basically the families around her were all working families, and she saw that a lot of times mothers and fathers both had to go out to work, and the mothers often had to leave their children at home alone because they just couldn't afford childcare.
She cut quite a dashing figure.
Yes, she did. I mean, she was very dramatic. Her appearance was very dramatic, and I think that that was a big part of her image when she was younger. When you look at newspaper clippings or articles about her, they always talk about how beautiful she was and how striking she looked and just what a presence she had. I think she had a lot of charisma and just an incredible ability to connect with her audience, and that really carried through throughout her whole life.
Why did you get interested in her?
My first book, which was called Breadwinners, was about working class women and economic independence. And that was looking at women who became active in the labor movement in New York City, but also in some other cities like Chicago and Boston, and looking at these kind of early struggles for economic independence. So it was really about the ways that working class women got interested in feminism. So that was my first book, and it went from 1865 until 1920, which is when women won the vote. And Flynn always kind of intrigued me because she seemed like a little bit of an outlier to this group. This first group of women that I looked at were really focused on winning the vote. They were focused on reform. And Flynn actually intrigued me because she wasn't interested in winning the vote. She actually rejected the vote. She thought it was a waste of time. She was very interested in labor, but she took this totally, really a more revolutionary kind of approach to it.
So she rejected the vote. Even though she worked for the rights of labor throughout her life, she had a nuanced view of unions. Mm-hmm. What was that all about?
Her views really evolved, and one of the things that was interesting about writing the book was just all of the decades of activism and the ways that her views changed. So when she began, she started off as a socialist. And then she went into the Wobblies, or the industrial workers of the world. And they definitely called for revolution. They wanted direct action. They saw the state as basically being oppressive, and they thought that workers needed to organize together to form cooperatives, which they imagined would be the beginning of really a new society. So it was a very utopian vision. The Wobblies were pretty much crushed during World War I, and the labor movement was really in the doldrums in the 1920s. And then in the 1930s, this kind of new labor movement emerged, really coming out of the response to the Great Depression, the New Deal, the Congress of Industrial Organizations, and also the Communist Party. And so then when Flynn kind of came back into the labor movement in the 30s and 40s, it was really quite a different labor movement. But she personally felt a lot of continuities. You know, she felt one of the reasons that she was so excited about the Congress of Industrial Organizations and the Communist Party was she felt like they were picking up on a lot of strains of that earlier activism in the Wobblies that felt like it had been really crushed by World War I and the Red Scare. So I think for her to see that kind of come back to life in the 30s created this feeling of continuity, even though, you know, if you look at these movements, they're usually seen as being pretty different, you know, and they were different. I mean, the times changed.
And you said before that her view was more revolutionary. So why was she a revolutionary? What was it about capitalism? What was her critique?
She just thought that workers were never going to get anywhere in a capitalist society. She just didn't really believe that reform would ever do enough. She thought that capitalists were in charge of the government. They were going to make the laws to suit themselves. And that even if workers did manage to get some labor legislation passed, it wouldn't really be significant and they would have difficulty enforcing it. And she also just really thought that people needed to be active on their own behalf. You know, she thought that workers were really oppressed by capitalism and she wanted them to see them really empowered. And so she imagined that as happening through these radical social movements. And I think that's what made her a revolutionary.
So as you said before, she got involved with the International Workers of the World, the IWW, the Wobblies. There was a big case in Spokane where she was arrested. It was a very big deal. Tell us what happened.
The battles for free speech really started in the Pacific Northwest in the early 1900s. And I don't think that people realize that. I think people think that the battle for free speech starts with the American Civil Liberties Union, and they have been really important advocates for free speech. But actually, the battle began with the Wobblies trying to organize in these lumber and mining towns like Spokane or Missoula. And their technique of organizing was to go into town and basically start talking. And they would start criticizing the employment agencies. There were all of these kind of transient workers coming through town looking for a job. Often they would get ripped off by these employment agencies. And so the Wobbly strategy to start organizing these people was to kind of set up shop on a street corner and basically start talking and try to gather a crowd. Needless to say, this didn't go over very well with the town authorities, and they started either passing or invoking ordinances against speaking on city streets. So at this point, although there was a First Amendment right to free speech, it was really about the federal government, and it wasn't clear that there couldn't be municipal ordinances against people speaking freely. And so the Wobblies started challenging that, and Flynn was really on the forefront. At this point, she was only about 19 years old, so she was not an incredibly experienced organizer because, you know, her career had begun when she was about 16. But she decided the way to deal with this was to actually call more people into town, to get more people involved in the protest. And so it was like these mass arrests. They basically courted arrest, and as a result, they filled the jail. They all demanded trials, so they kind of tied up the legal system. And eventually the town just kind of got tired of fighting them and gave up and granted them the right to free speech. And so these early battles in Missoula and Spokane were the first of about 24 battles that took place in cities across the country.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Lara Vapnick about her biography of the great labor organizer, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn.
And she got acquitted.
Yeah.
And her co-defendant, who was an Italian man, was convicted, although he eventually went free. But still, you use this to illustrate some interesting things about how she was treated because of her gender and how immigrants were treated because of their status.
In her early years, she got arrested many times, and she was never kept in prison for more than a night or two. And part of it had to do with the fact that she was this very attractive young woman. She was white. She was Irish-American, but she didn't have an accent, so she very much read as American. And she just seemed like a sympathetic character. I think she was probably pretty good at talking her way out of things because she got into a lot of scrapes. But if an immigrant man was charged with a similar crime, he would not be given the benefit of the doubt. There was a lot of fear of immigrants, especially working class immigrants, and they were treated very harshly by the police and by jailers. And she was definitely self-conscious of the fact that as a woman, she was kind of given a pass. And I think she felt like she had to use that privilege to try to help other people.
A lot of people would be surprised to think that her gender was a privilege, and of course it was in this way, but in other ways, she struggled. How was her position in the movement constructed by her gender?
Her position was so linked to her gender. In the IWW, she became almost this female embodiment of liberty. So she was this real symbol for the movement. She was a great speaker. She brought audiences. She brought publicity because when she got arrested, it was news, unlike an immigrant man getting arrested. So she was really used in a way because she drew attention to the cause. And I think she was self-conscious about that. And it was a cause she wanted to draw attention to. But when it came to making decisions about policy, she was definitely marginalized. So although she was known as being, you know, as good or better a public speaker as any of the men, she was not setting the policy for the Wobblies. So she was definitely marginalized and as a result had some disagreements with Big Bill Haywood, who became the leader of the Wobblies during World War I. And I think a similar thing happened with the Communist Party. They really wanted Elizabeth Gurley Flynn because she was such a symbol of American radicalism. And in the 1930s, they were really trying to sell themselves as an American movement. And she was such an American figure that they really wanted her to be involved. But again, I think they kind of used her to draw attention, to build an audience. But when it came time to make decisions, even though for most of her tenure in the Communist Party, she was on the national board, her opinions were not necessarily listened to the same way a man's opinions would be listened to.
And yet she comes across in your book as being someone who had a very sophisticated political understanding, possibly ahead of her time.
I think that's absolutely true. And one of the reasons I think it was so sophisticated is that she was really trying to think about the intersections between class and gender. Gender was really important to her, but she just didn't think that women's issues could be separated from broader issues of working class power. So I think in trying to bring those two things together, it led her to develop a very kind of nuanced perspective.
Could you say a little bit more about that?
I think her view on it, I mean, she certainly had her family perspective, her mother's strong feminist perspective. But then when she went out and became an organizer and started talking to people in places like Lawrence, Massachusetts, where she led a big strike in 1912, she realized that working class women faced very particular challenges. So she talked to these women, she would stay in workers' homes, and she found out that they really struggled to combine the care for their family with the wage earning that they had to do. They really couldn't make a choice between either or. They had to do both. So that made her aware of problems like low wages generally, the fact that women got paid less than men, and then also the fact that these women didn't have access to birth control. They had big families. They had to struggle to feed them, and they couldn't control their own reproduction. So that really led her to advocate birth control.
That was a famous strike in Lawrence called the Bread and Roses Strike. You have a thrilling account of it. Tell us a little bit about that strike and the Children's Crusade. I mean, the whole amazing innovative tactics that she developed.
Yeah, and that was one thing that really impressed me about her as I was researching is she was so creative in what she did. She didn't really have a preset idea of what she was going to do. And it seems like she was able to go into a situation like Lawrence and really talk to people, form alliances, and think creatively about ways to support women's activism, especially. And she knew that to support the women, she had to address issues of what to do with the children. And so the Children's Crusade was this idea that actually she and Margaret Sanger, who was another early birth control advocate, came up with of taking the children out of Lawrence and sending them to live with strike sympathizers in a number of different cities, including New York. So New York City, Philadelphia, Barre, Vermont. Children were sent out to live in different communities. And these images of strikers' children, these gaunt, not very well, warmly dressed children flowing out of Lawrence, you know, during the winter and going to these other families, that drew a lot of media attention. So it drew public attention to the strike. And I think it made people realize that these workers in Lawrence were trying to support their family. I think, again, that image, most of them were immigrants, so that image of that they were dangerous labor radicals, which is probably how they would have normally been painted. I think with the Children's Crusade, Flynn kind of managed to upend that and show them as people, as family supporters, and I think the children were an important part of that.
And we're talking with historian Lara Vapnick. Her biography is Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, Modern American Revolutionary.
And the slogan of Bread and Roses, say what that was about.
So it was this idea that women wanted more than bread, right? They wanted bread. They deserved bread. They felt like they wanted equal pay for their work. But they also wanted to be able to enjoy life. They wanted to have time off for leisure. They wanted to be able to purchase the goods that they produced. And they wanted to have, you know, enough time to be with their families. So I think it kind of speaks to the broader aspirations of the sort of organizing that Flynn was involved in. This might sound a little cheesy, but I think they wanted to have a part of the American dream.
The strike in Lawrence, which was successful, was followed by another great strike in Paterson, New Jersey, which was less successful. But again, she advanced some of these new tactics, alliances, cross-class alliances. Mm-hmm. It was very interesting how you explore this in your book and how she who she worked with.
Yeah, that was actually something I found in my research that sort of surprised me, because Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, she's often quoted as saying around the time of these strikes, the sisterhood of women, like the brotherhood of man, is a hollow sham, you know? So she was known for rejecting the idea of sisterhood across classes. And that was part of the rhetoric of the industrial workers of the world. They were always emphasizing class. And, you know, she definitely believed in that. But what I discovered is that she actually was really smart about making alliances with people who were sympathetic. And it wasn't just strategic. She also made genuine friendships with people like Mary Heaton Vorse, who was a labor journalist who she met during the Lawrence strike. They actually remain lifelong friends. They came from very different class backgrounds. Vorse was from a very privileged background, and Flynn was certainly from a much more working class background, but they really shared a desire to see workers improve their lives. They shared a critique of capitalism. They were concerned about issues of free speech, and that was another area where she was really smart at building alliances, especially during the Paterson strike. Paterson is just a train ride away from New York City. And at this time, there were all of these radicals living in Greenwich Village, exploring all different kinds of artistic expression and different lifestyles. And some of those people got interested in the Paterson strike, and they started writing about it. Some of them contributed money. So they became actually important supporters of the labor movement. And she was pretty good at recruiting these people to act in a supporting role, but also not letting them take over the movement. And I was really impressed by that, because for my earlier book, what I saw is that oftentimes cross-class alliances would end up with the middle-class women calling the shots. And Flynn was pretty savvy in not letting that happen. So she would bring people in as allies, but they tended to help on her terms.
She also met Emma Goldman.
Yeah. She met Emma Goldman, and Emma Goldman actually has a great description of Flynn in her memoir, Living My Life. She talks about the first time she met Flynn, or the first time she noticed Flynn, and she was speaking in New York City, and she saw Elizabeth Gurley Flynn in the audience sitting there with her father, and she just noticed this woman who was young woman who was listening, you know, so intently. And so she actually noticed Flynn, I think, before she became a public speaker. But then when Flynn did start, Goldman was very supportive. And one of the documents I found that was cool was a book of Emma Goldman's essays that she sent to Flynn. And she dedicated it to the first American woman rebel.
That's great. Now, Emma Goldman was deported from the U.S. Her lover, Alexander Berkman, was imprisoned for many years. Goldman herself was imprisoned. Talk about the repression, the incredibly brutal repression that came down, especially under Woodrow Wilson. And we are still operating under some of those laws, like the Espionage Act, that Wilson passed.
Yeah, the repression was really chilling, actually. Reading about it firsthand, reading letters that people wrote to Flynn from prison or from Ellis Island, where detainees were held, I was really quite shocked. I mean, and I'm a historian, so I knew about the Red Scare. This shouldn't have been news to me, but actually reading the first-person accounts and just realizing how suddenly the government cracked down, how little warning these people had. Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman were deported along with this whole group of Russian refugees. Most of the people that they were on the boat with didn't even have clothing with them. They didn't have clothing, they didn't have money, they didn't have their passports, they didn't even know where they were going until they were halfway across the Atlantic Ocean. So this element of shock, I think, was very much part of the government strategy. They actually really wanted to surprise people, and they did. But individual lives were totally shattered by it. Families were destroyed. It was really brutal, you know. And then these people spent years in prison, and they experienced a lot of brutality in prison. It was a very, you know, dark time.
And Elizabeth Gurley Flynn herself was charged with sedition.
Yeah, she was one of 168 IWW leaders who was charged with seditious conspiracy. And she actually managed to get her case severed, so she didn't end up serving time in prison. And this is something that she did that is actually controversial. And some historians have felt like, you know, she got herself off and left these other people to go to prison, which is what Big Bill Haywood told everybody to do. But I think I believe her when she says that she just didn't think that was a good strategy. She knew from the past, from these free speech battles that she had fought in the early 1900s, that basically if there was not enough evidence to convict somebody individually, the state would tend to use conspiracy charges against labor activists. So she didn't think it was a good idea to keep all of the cases together. She thought it was much better to divide them and let the government try to prove its case against each individual. That's much harder to do than to make this allegation of conspiracy, especially during wartime.
So talking about the connections from her time to today, what do you feel is her relevance for us?
Well, I think what's interesting about her is that she touched on so many different areas. I mean, she had a lot to say about gender equality, but really thinking about the materialist aspects of it, issues of kind of wages and childcare and social supports for working mothers. But then there's also the labor side of it. She was a huge advocate for labor organization and just thought that if workers were not organized, they were not going to get anywhere. And then there was a third part of it, which is her advocacy of free speech, which is still an issue now. So I think what's kind of extraordinary about her is that she brings these three different areas together. I can't think of a contemporary figure, you know, that would draw together those three different things the way that she did.
Well, it's a terrific read, this biography of Elizabeth Gurley Flynn. Laura Vapnick, thank you so much for talking with us here.
Thank you for having me.
Lara Vapnek's book is Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, Modern American Revolutionary. You can hear our extended conversation about Elizabeth Gurley Flynn by going to writersvoice.net. If you're in the New York City area on Wednesday, March 25th, you can hear Vapnek talk about Elizabeth Gurley Flynn at the Tenement Museum on the Lower East Side at 6:30 p.m. Next up, we talk with civil rights lawyer, writer, and radio host Bill Newman. Stay tuned after the break.
As we go marching, marching in the beauty of the day, a million darkened kitchens, a thousand mill lofts gray, are touched with all the radiance that a sudden sun discloses. For the people hear us singing, bread and roses, bread and roses.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In our first segment today, we learned that the fight for civil liberties did not begin, as many may think, with the American Civil Liberties Union. It began with the Wobblies at the turn of the 20th century. But the ACLU has certainly been the guardian of those liberties through the decades since its founding in 1920. Journalist and lawyer Bill Newman has made the struggle to gain and protect civil liberties a touchstone of his life, since his days working with prisoners in New York City in the 1960s down to today. That fight grew out of his larger commitment to social justice, which he chronicles in his recent memoir, When the War Came Home, out from Levelers Press. Drawn from published essays he's written through the years, When the War Came Home connects the dots between past and present, from the anti-war, civil rights, and environmental struggles of yore to those happening today. Bill Newman has been the director of the Western Massachusetts office of the ACLU for more than 25 years. He won the first gay custody case to go before a state Supreme Court and successfully defended former underground radicals charged with seditious conspiracy. He also is a newspaper columnist, the host of a weekday radio talk show in Western Massachusetts, and the author and voice of The Civil Liberties Minute. Well, Bill Newman, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I loved reading this book, When the War Came Home, because so much of it was familiar to me. In fact, I think we're pretty close contemporaries. And you were involved in the movement in the 1960s, as did I. And that, in fact, is some of the reference of When the War Came Home. Explain for our listeners what is behind the title of your book.
There was a phrase, a slogan, a chant that we often screamed, yelled on the street saying, bring the war home, as in stop fighting in Vietnam and let's fight racism and poverty and indignities here in the United States. Bring the war home. There's a war to be fought here. Let's stop killing people in Vietnam. Let's stop shedding American soldiers' blood. Let's stop destroying a country. And then Kent State happened. And many people in the movement had said, you know, someday they're going to start shooting and killing college kids. You just wait. They're going to do that. And I said it. And then Kent State happened, and we were 3 or 3.5 hours away in Yellow Springs, Ohio. And in a moment, life changed as far as I was concerned, because the war had come home. There were, in fact, National Guardsmen shooting and killing college kids at a peaceful demonstration against the war. They were shooting and killing them. That was a watershed moment. Because I said it could happen, it might happen. I thought it was possible, but in my heart of hearts, I never really believed it. And then, and I think it was important for me, but I think it was important for the country as well, because it was a time where white kids, frankly, now were being treated like African Americans. This is what happens when the police have all the power and they can shoot and they can kill.
Give us a context. Why were we out in the streets then?
I think actually it raises the ancillary question, which is, why aren't we out in the streets now? Mm. Because it was, I think, this congruence of political and social and personal ethos that came together. And it was part of, I think, a borrowing from the civil rights movement, borrowing from Martin Luther King Jr., and people being involved in massive demonstrations and being on the streets was part of the gestalt of the times. It was to not be on the streets would have been unthinkable. And mass demonstrations were the order of the day, and properly so. And they had an influence, and it mattered because those demonstrations, and there's a piece of this in the book too. I said we were at the demonstration in Columbus, Ohio, after Kent State. And I said, well, they had the police and the National Guard and guns and mace and batons, and we had buttons and black armbands and NBC News. It was, in fact, how the media covered these events that was different, that was important, and that really made a difference.
I'd like to talk a little bit about you. You start the book in almost a similar setting, but a long time ago, when you were involved as a student at Antioch College in Ohio, you had come to New York City to participate in a project that it really sounds would not be possible today. Tell us about that project and how that inspired you. Did it inspire you to become a lawyer?
Antioch College functions on a work-study program. I went to college the summer after I graduated high school. I'd been there for 3 months, and after 3 months, time to go be in the world and work. And the Vera Institute of Justice, and specifically what was then called the Manhattan Court Employment Project, decided it wanted to hire Antioch College students for co-op jobs to come work as screeners at this rehabilitation and diversion experimental diversion project in the New York City criminal courts. And I knew from Borscht. I was just a naive 18-year-old and somehow got hired to be one of the four students hired. And we were working in the New York criminal courts. And it was a world I didn't know, hadn't experienced. All of the counselors in the program were ex-cons. They had served an average of 8 or 9 or 10 years in upstate New York prisons. They were really tough. These were the guys who were going to counsel the arrestees who were going to come into the program, who were going to be diverted. They would have to participate in counseling. They would have to either get a job. The program would help secure for them or go to a training program, something like that, stay out of trouble. And if all that worked, then the charges against them would be dismissed. I was working in the arraignment session most of the time in these cell blocks that were just gross, just disgusting. It was an experience of a world that I didn't know existed, and it changed my life. It didn't exactly make me want to be a lawyer. I wasn't really sure about that at all, but I was sure that I wanted to do something about the horrifying injustice that I saw every day.
And you became a civil rights lawyer.
I did. I came to it through criminal defense work, really, and was hired by the ACLU of Massachusetts to reconstitute the Western Massachusetts office, and that was 1987. And it was fortunate because we didn't have to spend too much time right at the beginning, and I didn't have that much time that particular year because I was involved in the sedition trial in Springfield. These were individuals who were identified as the Ohio 7 or the Ohio 8. They were charged with seditious conspiracy, seditious conspiracy being a conspiracy to overthrow the United States government by force and violence. And that trial, that litigation, took a couple years. And during that time, we really created the infrastructure for the Western Massachusetts ACLU office. These are unrelated because I did the seditious conspiracy case along with all my colleagues and other defense lawyers on the case as part of my private practice. But that was the beginning. Those were the beginning years for the reconstituted Western Massachusetts ACLU office.
Hmm. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Bill Newman. He's a civil rights lawyer and an author and a radio personality in the Pioneer Valley of Western Massachusetts. His book is When the War Came Home. Talking about civil rights, it was a very interesting chapter in your book, which I was quite surprised to find my own case in, although I think you didn't know it was my case.
Not a clue till we walked into the studio.
This chapter is called Jew Boy, and it's about racism and anti-Semitism in the traditionally known as liberal community of Western Massachusetts. You know, the free territory of liberated territory of Western Massachusetts, where there is still a fair amount of racism and even of anti-Semitism. First, tell us a little bit about why did you write this article? What was behind this?
The book is a collection, but it also has an arc. To me, it tells the story of the ethos of the anti-Vietnam War movement and what happened. What did we do with it? Where has it manifested itself? Where have we failed? And my thesis that I set out in the beginning, and this is not an academic book by any stretch, it is rather a series of portraits and vignettes about how we have lived our lives. And I think that what inspired me to write about that particular case and to make this chapter about anti-Semitism and racism in the Valley is I think we have to recognize that this is not the People's Republic of Amherst, and there is lots of racism and homophobia that still exists here, no matter what we say to the contrary. And oh, by the way, if you want to talk about racism, can we talk about Holyoke? Can we talk about Springfield, which is right down the road? Can we talk about the way in which the enormous homophobia that existed in Franklin County when we tried the Bunny King case, the first gay-lesbian...
Let's say something about that case.
Bunny King, it was the first gay custody case, probably the first gay rights case to go before a state's highest court. We tried the case in Franklin County in 1979, Wendy Sibbison and I, and we lost because according to the judge in this case in which mom, Bunny King, is seeking the return of her children from a guardianship, according to the judge, her being a lesbian in and of itself creates an element of instability in the household that makes her an unfit mother. And we took that case up to the Supreme Judicial Court, where we won, came back down to Franklin County, tried the case again, and we won, and her kids were returned to her. But this was not necessarily a bastion of liberalism or progressivism. It wasn't. And it was, although the righteousness of the cause was clear, the eventual outcome while we were doing it was not.
In fact, her kids had originally been awarded to a friend of hers who had become a fundamentalist Christian and therefore decided that homosexuality was wrong and she wasn't going to allow Bunny to see her kids.
That's right.
And, you know, what a difference just a few decades has made.
Right. It gives me optimism. I mean, and what I say and the reason I write about our children in the book is because I think that their generation has a chance, in fact, to realize some of these goals that those of us who participated and my participation was really foot soldier-esque at most, that we dreamt about. And some of the things that we dreamt about actually are real. I mean, if you had said in 1968, 1970, 1972, we'll have a black president within your lifetime, say, really? I don't know. Thanks, but I don't really believe it. We'll have a woman president, and I think we will, within your lifetime. And gay marriage, if you had said, oh, by the way, people will no longer be arrested for marijuana offenses, marijuana will be legalized within your lifetime. I think that all of these things show that America has, in fact, changed a lot. Not enough, but a lot. So it is the glass half full perspective, which I occasionally find myself. I think the world has changed somewhat.
Those are hopeful words. Let's talk about the new Jim Crow, because I think this is a very important theme in your book. The new Jim Crow, maybe explain the concept and how you first started thinking about it.
Well, the phrase is the title to Michelle Alexander's book, and what she's talking about, the social experiment we have been involved in for the past four decades of mass incarceration, which is the new Jim Crow. We have gone from some 400,000 or 500,000 Americans or people held in American prisons and jails to 2 million 400,000 It is a mass experiment in putting people of color behind bars and locking up and destroying their lives and their families and seeing what happens. We have, in addition to that, another 6 to 7 million people who are under correctional control, probation and parole and the like. And there are, of course, millions others who are have collateral consequences that they're carrying around prison records and or convictions, can't get jobs, can't get housing, and so on. So there are tens of millions of people directly involved in the system one way or another, and tens and tens of millions more whose families are involved in the system. And mostly this is an experiment of putting people in prison who don't need to be there, for whom there is no social benefit of putting them in prison. They are low-level drug users. They are addicts. They are people who are mental health issues. This is not about making the streets safer. It's about locking up black and brown people because that wins votes in suburban America. Mm-hmm. And politicians have exploited that fear for decades and decades. And here we are reaping the fruits of this horrifyingly racist public policy. Lock up people, throw away the key. And the fact that they don't, not only do they not need it, but it makes us less safe at a cost of hundreds of billions of dollars a year. It's a social experiment. If we framed it that way, if we looked at it that way and say, okay, we're going to do an experiment. We'll put 2 million people disproportionately black and brown. We'll put them in jail and we'll see what happens. People would be outraged. And yet when we say, oh, that's the law, we're just standing up for the law, my goodness, then it's okay. And finally, not because we've become more compassionate, but because it's become so expensive, there is a significant pushback and say, wait a second, this is a system that has to change. It has to stop. We have to be better than this.
And we're talking with Bill Newman. His book, which is a collection of articles that he wrote as a columnist for the Daily Hampshire Gazette in Western Massachusetts, is When the War Came Home. Those are powerful words. Sentencing, you just said throw away the key. I mean, the thing that has shocked me so much is the sheer length of sentences in this country.
Right. They're disproportionately long compared to any other country in the world. We have 5% of the world's population, approximately. We have 25% of the world's prisoners. The sentencing here compared to any other Western nation is absolutely disproportional. And it runs the gambit from incarceration initially to sentences that are 2, 5, 10 times longer than they would be in, for example, Western European countries.
How did this happen?
I think it's a political response. Nixon ran on law and order. Agnew ran on law and order. Reagan ran on law and order. And the implied message is we will protect you well-to-do, white people in the suburbs, from your greatest fear, or what we will make your greatest fear, which is black and brown men. We'll make them the enemy, and we'll put them in jail for you. All you got to do is vote for us. And I think that subliminal message, sometimes subtle and sometimes not subtle at all, as in the ads, the Willie Horton ads against Governor Dukakis when he ran for president, I think they were successful. And as long as you win elections and keep winning elections, you'll keep doing it.
You say that there's been a pushback against that.
I think that's true. I think that you have seen, particularly in states that are facing significant budget pressures, that they're saying, wait a second, it costs $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 or more a year to lock somebody up. There's no real reason to lock that person up. And when they get out, the odds of them committing another crime are extremely high because, of course, we have no rehabilitation programs in the prisons and jails. We don't have educational programs. So if they came in an addict, they'll probably leave, and within a short period of time after being released, they'll be back to being an addict. And they say, this is an immense waste of money. And I think that makes politicians change because they want to deliver other kinds of goods and services and tax relief to their constituents. And spending money that is a clear waste of human beings and a clear waste of time and a clear waste of the money, that strikes them as a bad idea. Some. We still have 2.4 million people behind bars.
It struck me in reading your book, Bill Newman, and reading When the War Came Home, that, you know, we just had the U.S. Senate release a report on torture. And as I was reading your book, I was thinking, We need a torture report here at home because of the conditions in jails. You talk about Marion, the Marion experiment, which became the norm. Tell us what that was and what that means.
This was a piece that was first published in the Massachusetts Review. Marion was the supermax. It then moved to Colorado. And the supermax is an experiment in sensory deprivation. Lock these, generally men, I think all men in Marion, up 23 or 24 hours a day. Don't allow them to communicate. Don't let them talk to anyone. Put them for their exercise in another cage for maybe an hour. And this is a supermax prison, and this is the United States of America. And I call it Marionizing Massachusetts because, in fact, in Massachusetts, we have cell blocks at what was called Walpole State Prison, but now has been bucolically renamed Cedar Junction. And this use of sensory deprivation and isolation has become commonplace in the United States, where on any given day, we have many tens of thousands of prisoners who are being literally driven crazy by this social experiment, which again has no or limited at best utility in terms of safety in the prisons. We're putting kids in isolation. We're putting adults and keeping them there. Used to be, you know, this was a serious, serious penalty for a serious infraction, and you're going to go to the hole for a week. It's really serious. And now we keep people there, such as in Pelican Bay in California. We keep them there for months, for years, for decades. It's horrifying.
It is horrifying. As a civil rights lawyer, what's your sense how to fight this?
I think that this needs to be won, to the extent it can be, still be won in courts. I think that it needs to be won in legislatures, and it needs to be won in the court of public opinion. And people need to see the images, which is, of course, why they don't allow cameras inside, and to read the reports, which is, of course, why they don't allow newspaper reporters inside. But that said, it also needs to be won in the court of public opinion, because I sincerely believe if people saw what was being done in our name, they would say, no, I didn't mean to torture people. We torture people in our prisons here. We torture them abroad. They're different kinds of torture.
The death penalty. You were involved in a couple of death penalty cases.
I was significantly involved in one in Georgia, and I learned a lot from doing it, and I learned a lot from working with Brian Stevenson, who has a brilliant new book out. Brian Stevenson is the founder of the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, and Brian is an amazing lawyer, an amazing person, and has just the most generous and, I think, giving kind of soul.
About those cases, tell us a little bit about your involvement and your conclusions.
I was pushed a bit by my friend David Hoos to take a death penalty case. David is the premier criminal defense lawyer in Western Massachusetts and one of the leading anti-death penalty lawyers in the United States, and he's done a number of cases. He had one at the time. He had a client in Georgia, and he said, you should take a death penalty case, because at the time, there were no systems set up in death penalty case, and particularly in the death belt in the South. There were no systems in those states for representation after someone's murder conviction and death penalty sentence had been affirmed by the state Supreme Court. There were no lawyers, and they were looking for volunteer lawyers from the North to help. And George Kendall, who was running the ACLU's regional office in Atlanta, he sends me these decisions from the Georgia Supreme Court, and one was of a kid who either did nothing or did very, very little in terms of participation in this crime. The older man who had dragged him into it had committed suicide as part of the homicide that he committed. This was an 18-year-old young man who did not know what was going to happen, and he's on a bus going home to see his mother. The other guy has committed suicide, which he brought with him from the house where he committed these murders, and drank the paraquat to kill himself after if he had lived, they would have tried to kill him, the state would have. But because he had already killed himself and they wanted to kill somebody, they had to go after Kenny, 18 years old, no prior record, foster homes, aged out of foster care. That's how he's ended up under the influence of this guy. But someone has to pay, and the state's going to impose this vengeance, and the state's going to kill somebody, and the person they really wanted to kill was already dead, so they went after Kenny. And that was the case.
We're talking with Bill Newman. His book is When the War Came Home. So now looking back, you talked about the glass half full. We've had, you know, since 2001, 9/11, we've had a steady erosion, it seems, of civil liberties in this country. Do you think we can come back from the hole that we have been digging into, but, you know, between a foreign policy that kills people abroad without due process and massive surveillance here at home? What are your thoughts on where we stand now and where we're going?
I'm not optimistic. I don't see a good solution to how we're going to put the technology genie back in the bottle. I don't see how that's going to happen. And we are, for the most part, willing participants in allowing the government to accumulate vast amounts of data about all of us. We allow corporations to do it. Corporations feed it to the government. A lot of it is available online. Facebook is, in some ways, the enemy. And a lot of social media is as well. And the government takes all of that and all your credit card information and all your toll booth information and all your Facebook information, and they create this amalgam, and the government can know virtually anything about you. And the government says, but we're not using it, which is true. They're not using it until they want to use it. And then they have it all. And so the potential for there to be a kind of militarized police state is huge. And when it's necessary, the government will have the ability to do what it wants to do because it will have all the information about you and me that it needs.
Those are sobering words. And I think they're often not articulated that way. People don't go that one more step that you've gone to point out that, okay, you know, people say, oh, I don't care, I'm not doing anything wrong. But they don't understand, like you do, where that can go.
And the I didn't do anything wrong, it's not about me, unfortunately, is not protection. Because the job that you didn't get because someone said something about you that was completely untrue, that's in a file somewhere that you can't see, that you don't know about, you'll never know. The reason you were targeted and pulled over and ended up being arrested, even though you were acquitted 2 years later for something that was said that was in some file, you'll never know. And the steady erosion of privacy, I fear, has reached a turning point, in part because the generations that came after us accept it. Oh, they know everything anyway. What's the difference? Well, there actually is a huge difference. But to the extent that we accept that privacy is a quaint concept, we're in huge trouble.
Yeah, I think you're right about it being generational. I mean, we may have been born after World War II, but we grew up under its shadow, and we did understand what a police state of mass surveillance was like because we saw it on the movies on TV and our parents talked about it.
And because East Germany was a police state, and because Russia and the USSR to a significant degree was a police state, and there were American supported dictatorships around the world that were police states. And we said, never here, never here, never in the United States. We're different. We're a democracy. We believe in freedom. We believe in privacy. We believe in restricting the government and not allowing the government to run our lives and rule our lives and know everything about us. That is totally un-American, except that today it's very American.
Another reason why people should read your book, Bill Newman, I want to thank you so much for coming and talking with us here on Writer's Voice about When the War Came Home.
It's been a total pleasure, Francesca. Thank you so very much.
Lawyer, journalist, and radio host Bill Newman. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to an excerpt from his book, When the War Came Home. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox, or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter @WritersVoice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.